For the week of December 7th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 260, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Alfred, New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
You're in Alfred, New York?
I am. No, I'm not. Alfred is where my friend lives. I'm near Beacon, New York.
Okay, because you do know that there is an Alfred, New York.
I know. My friend lives there.
Okay.
It's like 5 hours north of Manhattan. It's nowhere near where I am, but there you go.
Yes, it's quite far from New York City.
That's right. I'm at a country estate, a Jacobean setting for the week, and that's where I'm recording the show this week.
Now, Jacobean, you mean like of Chekhov, having to do with Chekhov.
What else could I possibly mean?
I don't know, but the last time you said that, I was like, what did he mean by Jacobean? And I kept looking up J-A-C-K-O-V-I. I couldn't figure it out.
That's where we're recording it this week. We will have a show next week. We're not sure if we should have one on Christmas week and New Year's week. We know people time shift a lot, but do they care about our show during the holidays? Maybe we will. Maybe we won't. We'll try and let you know more next week. If you're really excited, say, no, record a show on December 22nd. Email us, text us, Facebook us. How can they do that, Sperling?
Well, they can do that by emailing dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter. At showbizsandbox is our handle there. Or you can search for us on Facebook, where we have a page under facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
So what will we talk about this week?
Well, I mean, do I even have to say?
Yes. Yes, you do.
Well, on this week's show, we're going to talk about the only subject everyone in the entertainment business seems to be able to talk about right now, the cyber attack on Sony Pictures Entertainment. It's now being called the largest and most damaging hack against a U.S.-based business in history. We'll try to answer some of the questions on people's minds concerning the incident. Questions like, was it an inside job? Could it be the work of a disgruntled former employee? Is North Korea behind the hack? Where can I download the 100 terabytes of leaked documents? You may be surprised to hear which company wants to compete with IMAX to build premium large format theaters. We'll not only tell you who they are, but what the real motive is for even wanting to get into that market. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from this past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're looking at the box office around the world. We get our information from Box Office Mojo. We get a link from Rentrak. That is our main source for worldwide box office. We go to Hollywood Reporter. We go to Variety. We go to all those folks to pull information on the movies. And the number one movie around the world is, of course, The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 1. It made another $53 million. It's at $560 million worldwide.
I'm just glad that the title isn't very long. I mean, could you imagine all the ticketing companies and the, you know, having to put all that on the marquee? Thank goodness it's all digital now.
Yeah, those poor kids, they would have been exhausted. Do they put Hunger Games 3? Do they put Mockingjay? What do they put? Well, you know, the big question is, they split it up into two parts. Is it making sense financially? The first film made $680 million worldwide. The second film made $850 million worldwide. Now we're on the third and fourth films, Mockingjay. It's already at $560 million. If it stopped tomorrow and part two made $560 million, they probably would have made the right bet or a similar bet or broken even, right? Because they need to make a lot more money by splitting up into two, because they had to pay more to the actors. They have to release it twice, do a whole new campaign, right? So it's not free money.
No. I mean, there's certainly a reason for wanting to cut it into two, because while it's not free money, you certainly do get some economies of scale.
Right. But, to say if it makes more than Catching Fire did, that it's a success, doesn't take into account all those extra expenses. I wonder how much extra it did cost to make this a two-parter rather than a one-parter. An extra $200 million, $250 million, because you've got, you know, the ad campaign worldwide, all that stuff. The actors wanted more money.
Yeah, I don't think that, your ad campaign and all of that will cost exactly...
That's a lot of money, right?
Yeah, it'll cost the same for both movies.
However, and they can be pretty expensive these days.
That's true, although your production budget won't be double.
No, I know, but it's a longer movie, so they probably shot for a longer time.
Right, but then at the same time, you get some serious discounts when you're renting equipment and doing contracts for below-the-line crew.
So, well, yeah, but you there would have been none of that if you hadn't made it into two movies instead of one. You get economies of scale, you know, making it longer. But if you just made one movie, well, you wouldn't have had any contracts to do for the second film.
Yes, that's true. I would say instead of it costing the same as making two movies, I would say it would probably is 1.5 to 1.75.
Well, now it says under production budget, when I'm looking at the numbers, it says that part one cost $125 million and part two cost $125 million. Are they just repeating that number?
I wouldn't be shocked. I mean, we're, as you know, trying to get budget numbers is very difficult. Unless, of course, you're trying to get budget numbers of a Sony film, in which case it's incredibly easy.
So, yeah, we don't know what the budget was for both films individually. We don't know how much extra it costs to make it two movies rather than one. We know they have to do a whole new ad campaign come November 20th of 2015. That's going to cost $50 to $70 million, right?
Probably around $50 million. Yeah.
Is that it for a worldwide ad campaign?
Yes, for a fourth installment of a movie that everybody is anticipating, yes.
Okay. So we'll have to see. But right now, it looks like a pretty smart bet. Because if it matches you know, number two, right, then they've got a whole other movie. And even if it costs the same amount again, they're going to make the same profit again.
And you were talking worldwide. So maybe it is $75 million. I know in the U.S., I would not be shocked if you said they spent $30 million advertising Mockingjay Part 1 in the U.S.
That's right. Well, the number two movie around the world is The Penguins of Madagascar. God bless them, right? This is $35 million it made this weekend. It's at about $150 million worldwide. Fox is distributing that film, but it is, of course, that's a DreamWorks animation movie, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and they've had a horrible year, and they wish this movie would make a lot more money.
That's true.
At number three is Interstellar, the Christopher Nolan film. I still haven't seen it. What about you, Sperling?
I am seeing it this week at a screening at the world-famous Chinese theater.
Are you working for them now?
No. If I was working for them, I would have said the TCL Chinese theater.
So now you are seeing it there. Why? Because is it on 70 millimeter? Is it IMAX? What are you seeing?
It is a 70 millimeter projection of the film. So, and it's dual projector, so there's two projectors being used that have to be synchronized.
Why is it dual projector?
To be able to throw the light, enough light onto the screen and to get the image that big.
Really?
That's what they needed to do, yes.
Wow, that's interesting.
It's a huge screen. It's one of the, I think it is the largest IMAX theater in the world.
Oh, it's an IMAX theater?
Yes.
Okay.
So it's 70 millimeter IMAX and it's on film. And I wanted to see, after 5-6 weeks, what does a film print look like these days, a 70 millimeter film print, no less, when it's been run through a projector three times a day for 5 to 6 weeks?
Now, the chances are in the old days, every movie was treated that way and they just didn't pay much attention. This movie is on film. It's probably the only film at that theater that's on actual celluloid.
It is.
So they're paying a lot of special attention to the care and cleaning of the machine, which would not have happened in the 70s and 80s. If you went to see a movie, you know, and they played for months and months. Not only was it on celluloid, a physical property, but it played for 6 months. So, you know, a hit film. So they really got run through the projectors hard. In this case, I'm imagining it'll probably be in pretty good shape.
Yeah. I mean, look, they had to find at the Chinese theater, they had to find the sound heads to be able to read the sound on the film. So, and that's true of all of the 70 millimeter, the places, the theaters where Interstellar was played back in 70 millimeter. They did not have the equipment and had to go out and scavenge for sound heads. In fact, they had to
A physical equipment to read the soundtrack that's on the celluloid.
That's right. Yes.
Okay. It sounded like geeks who were really into sound. Sound heads. I'm such a sound head.
No.
But that's not what you're saying.
No.
That movie has grossed about $600 million worldwide. That's a, you know, obviously a very successful film for Nolan. It costs a lot to make. Where it'll end up on his whole worldwide, you know, the career record, we'll have to wait and see.
Now, I've seen about three or four reels of it previously, both on film and digital. So I've seen portions of the film, but not all together.
So this will be the first time you see the whole movie.
That's true.
Right. So, and it did cost $165 million to make, nowhere near The Dark Knight Rises. That was at $275 million. That's his biggest film by far. But of course, that grossed $1 billion. This one is at $165 million budget. Perhaps we'll have to see where it ends up. And number four around the world is Fleet of Time. This is a Chinese romantic drama. It's based on a best-selling novel. I'm not familiar with it. It grossed $29 million. It's opening weekend in China alone. So I guess that muscled Interstellar aside, right? That's now the number one movie in China.
Yes.
At number five is Exodus, Gods and Kings. This is the Ridley Scott film. It's the retelling of Moses and the story of Exodus and the Ten Commandments. It stars Christian Bale. It grossed $23 million in 10 territories. It's doing quite well. It's a spectacle. It's based on the Bible. It's a known property. Don't discount it just because the reviews are mixed or okay or polite. This is still a very big property worldwide.
Well, I mean, the Bible's kind of dated. I don't know how many people have read the book.
Anyway, at number six around the world is, he's joking. Yeah, I knew you'd say that soon because you get scared. At number six around the world is Horrible Bosses 2, another $15 million. That's at $60 million and counting. Paddington, the live-action adaptation of the classic children's storybook that stars Colin Firth and Nicole Kidman, our newest, greatest romantic team on screen. They seem to be in every other movie together. That's grossed $13 million. It's at 19 territories. And it's at $15 million worldwide. This is mostly the weekend where it opened up. It made all its money this weekend. I guess it's in pretty small markets. At number eight is Big Hero 6, another $12 million. That's at $240 million worldwide. I'm not sure what big territories it has left. It's probably underperforming as far as Disney would like, given that it had pretty good reviews.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you. I think November was kind of busy for a lot of folks. And I know my kids haven't seen it yet, and they really want to. And now they're slowly forgetting about it.
Yes. And number nine is The Crossing. This is a Chinese film. It's directed by John Woo. I should call it The Crossing Part One. This is basically their Titanic. It's the story of a cruise ship that crashes into a cargo ship and everybody aboard virtually died. Only like 50 out of like 1,500 people survived. It took place during the 40s, during the Chinese Revolution. People were fleeing to Taiwan. And this film covers three couples. It focuses in on them. You know, instead of one romantic couple, you get three romantic couples and their varied fates. And the whole first film leads up to them getting on the ship. And in the second film, I guess it crashes.
So basically, everything is bigger in China. You don't get just one romance. You get three.
That's right. And it's not one movie, it's two, because part two literally is the sinking of the ship. I think it opens in May. John Woo did that with his last film, that period piece called Red Cliff. That came out in two parts. Two movies for the price of one is all the rage in Hollywood and I guess in movie studios around the world. But I would have assumed that because it was about people leaving China to go to Taiwan, that maybe the Chinese government wouldn't like that. But no, it's a Chinese film. It's showing in China and it made $8 million over the weekend.
So you're saying it's not a comedy?
No, it's not a comedy at all. Dumber and Dumber 2 is at about $120 million. And then The Pyramid, a horror movie. You may not care, but I do. A friend's cousin's son is one of the producers on this movie. So I have a link to the film.
Sort of. In a distant kind of... Actually, you have no link to the film at all.
I have no link to the film at all. I have no reason to say anything good or bad about it. Though it had caught my eye because a very good stage actor called Dennis O'Hare is in the movie. And I thought, you're seeing all these good actors in these horror movies, or this is really a more spooky movie rather than a horror film. You know what I mean, right?
Yes, sort of.
But you're seeing all these good actors in these franchises and these movies, you know, say, hey, maybe I can make money this way. And so there's Dennis O'Hare. I'm like, what is he doing there? But, it cost $5 million to make. That's the scuttlebutt that I heard. A lot of it went into The Pyramid itself. That was a big elaborate set. And the movie grossed $5 million worldwide on its opening weekend. Most of that overseas. It only made $1.3 million in North America. An incredibly slow weekend at the U.S. box office. And that movie managed to break into the top 10. If they'd actually advertised it a little bit more, maybe it would have done better. Because I felt like there was a missed opportunity there for some movie to step in. Because it was a pretty slow weekend. But what astonished my friend about this movie, he was paying attention. He's like, I don't see any ads. Where are the TV ads? Nothing on The Daily Show, nothing on The Colbert. Why aren't I seeing ads for this movie? The studio's just dumping it. And it's Fox as the distributor of this film. But as we've seen more and more movies, if you're targeting black women or young guys who like horror movies, You're not buying big TV ads, are you, Sperling?
No, because effectively you know what your target audience is, and to activate that market and that demographic, you just go after them directly. You don't have to do a blitz.
You put an ad on Twitch, which is the website where people watch other people playing video games, because you know that's where young men who love horror movies are hanging out.
That's right.
On the other hand, this may not be a good example of it, but if you have a movie that could cross over and reach a wider audience, you really are just burying the fact right there. You're giving up on anything better than that core audience, because the wider audience simply isn't going to know the movie came out.
Right. Well, at that point, you're hoping for a crossover hit where...
Well, no, I know, but you're giving up on the crossover hit before the movie even begins. You know, when you've got Beyond the Lights, which is a film about a black female singer breaking into the pop music world, got quite good reviews, a talented director, an interesting sort of movie. It's topping out at $13 million. They didn't advertise to anybody other than their core audience that they expected to turn out. They gave up on the possibility before it even began of reaching a wider audience.
Well, generally, a crossover hit will begin with its core demographic, and it's the core demographic that goes out and proselytizes and brings people in. So in a way, they're not necessarily giving up on it, but they're not... And by the way, if you look at My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which I guess isn't a crossover hit...
It's not a crossover hit. It's just a successful small film.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, you saw
it had great legs, but that is one in a million. In my point, I'm saying if you already have opening weekend of Pyramid, which only makes 1.3 million in the U.S., it's dead on arrival, and nobody else is going to say, "Oh, well, I'm interested." If you have your core audience excited, they can bring those other people in on opening weekend. In which case, you do better than expected, and then more people may come second weekend. But if your opening weekend, you're not even reaching out to other people, then it's not a movie that's on their radar. They're not going to get excited no matter what the word of mouth is. You know, it's really hard to reach a wider audience if they don't even know the movie exists.
Well, and I guess you have to ask yourself, you know, and I'm sure the studio was asking, well, are we going to spend $10 million to earn two?
Well, sure, of course. Yeah, of course. They just did the inexpensive social media campaign to reach the core horror movie people. They didn't turn out very well. It only made $1.3 million in the U.S., but, you know, we'll have to see. Who knows about the ultimates on this movie, right?
That's true. We'll explain what ultimates means by the end of the show. Stay tuned.
I've never heard that word before in my life. Women Who Flirt is a Chinese romantic comedy. That's at $18 million. That's what it's made so far. Fury is still chugging along, mostly overseas. It's at $180 million. I really want to see this movie. And then there is The French. This is a French movie, obviously. Well, not obviously, but it is. It's grossed $3 million. I assume it opened up in France. I mean, yes. I'd be surprised. It stars Jean Dujardin of The Artist. He plays a magistrate, a person of the law, who spends years trying to break the power of a drug ring. Now, that movie just snuck into the top 15. That's why we have info on it. If there had been a couple more big movies that came out this week, we might have lost track of it. Just like this Polish romantic comedy called Good Morning, I Love You. It's the number one film in that country, and it has been for a couple weeks. They've sold more than 500,000 tickets since opening on November 7th. It's never quite been big enough to break onto the worldwide charts because Poland isn't a big enough market. Even if it's the number one movie, they're not making enough movie for that market alone to send a movie into the top 10 or 20 worldwide. It's just not going to happen. But it is a big hit, and it's just one example of the many homegrown movies that are hits in their territories and that we can't always keep track of. I just happened to spot an item about it. We'd love to give more attention to movies like that. If there was an easy way to stay on top of movies that were number one by territory, if anybody knows of any suggestions, let us know. If you ever see a movie that's a big hit in Belgium or in the Netherlands and we haven't talked about it, let us know. We'd love to toss it out there. This movie is about a guy who's a young doctor. The girl is in big business. They meet cute. They have a nice little exchange, but they don't share their phone number or their emails, and they spend the rest of the movie trying to get back together. I see a Hollywood remake in the works.
No, yeah, that sounds like You've Got Mail. No, just kidding.
No, it doesn't sound like that at all. But anyway, I forgot to mention, it's been a couple weeks now, the Hunger Games movie reminded me there was another article about protesters in Thailand using the symbols of rebellion in the Hunger Games to show their displeasure with the government. I mean, that still blows my mind. People put holding up signs saying District Thai, which refers to the districts that they have in the Hunger Games. And the rebellion is crazy. Like, you're not allowed to be in public in groups of five people or more. So people get together in groups of four and they read George Orwell's 1984 or they read the Hunger Games to show their displeasure with the country. I mean, it's a sad situation. You know, our thoughts go with the protesters, but it's kind of amusing to see how Hollywood movies can influence even social protests.
Now, has Time Magazine picked its Person of the Year yet?
No, they've got a shortlist, though, which includes
Is the protester one of them? Because
it's not the protester. It is Ferguson protesters is one of them, but it should be protesters in general. That's a good possibility.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like one after the other. It's like whether it's Ferguson or New York or Hong Kong or Thailand, everybody's protesting.
I think they might have done that in a past year, so I'm not sure what the deal is. But I know the shortlist was just released. They announced the winner on Wednesday. We're recording the show on Monday. Taylor Swift is in the mix. God knows why. Why she would be Person of the Year. That just literally makes no sense to me.
I can tell you why. Because if you're a magazine editor, you want to sell magazines. And
the value of Person of the Year, diminishing that by naming somebody who has no particular importance, good or ill, is a stupid idea to sell. Then Justin Bieber would have been Person of the Year 10 times over. That's not how it works. It would be dumb if it worked that way. I'm not sure what their argument is. She's gone pop. So what? But Tim Cook is in the mix, the head of Apple, who came out as gay. The protesters in Ferguson and around the country related to that and other incidents involving the police and racial unrest. Not racial unrest. Involving the police doing bad policing.
Yes.
If that's the way to put it. So those are all in the mix. Last year was the Pope. So it's going to be a step down no matter what.
Yeah. I mean, once you start it with the Pope, I mean, you've got no place to go but then. They may as well pick Taylor Swift because then they have no place to go but up.
All right. Yeah. The Pope is often gets to be a Person of the Year at some point, just like most presidents do. But anyway, that's what's happening at the box office, though. It's not just what movies you see, but how you see them. Sperling is going to go see Interstellar in IMAX 70 millimeter.
That's
true. And
maybe
next year he'll want to go see a movie in Dolby. What? What is this?
I believe it's called Dolby Cinema.
So what is it? It's a competitor to IMAX. It's a big format. It's a film going environment. Picture,
yes.
Sound. It's going to be great.
Yes, they have everything from as you're walking in, the wayfinding says you're going down the hallways of a theater into the auditorium. The audio kind of like seeps in and you have a, you know, it's kind of like when you go to Disneyland or Universal Studios and you're kind of online and you can hear, I don't know, if you're on the Jurassic Park ride, you hear all the birds and it sounds like you're in the jungle.
Well, how many movies can they do that for?
I don't know, actually. It's a good question. Right. I mean, so Transformers, I could see. Transformers. But you know what? I don't think necessarily you're going to get, you know, Terms of Endearment. What are you going to put on for Terms of Endearment?
Weeping.
Yeah,
so
okay.
You've got IMAX with a growing business of big spectacle-type theaters. And Dolby says, hey, they're not even bothering to show them in IMAX, and they're still making money off the IMAX name. We've got a valuable name. Let's get in the business of big spectacle movie theaters. And so their offer to movie theaters is, hey, you build the space, we'll provide the very expensive equipment, and together we'll make money.
Right. Now, here's the issue. Let's back up to IMAX. IMAX takes a little bit of money. Out of the, you know, that's a licensing fee. They do a rev share on tickets, and it's a percentage of each theater's box office, okay? So that's what IMAX does. And as you say, Michael, IMAX, it's not even IMAX anymore in many theaters. It's you know,
just, we got a big screen.
Right. So in the days when you had IMAX, which was film, there was a reason to go because nobody could project an image that large. The prints themselves cost $20,000-$30,000 just to make an IMAX print. So It was an expensive proposition. There weren't that many theaters. A theater would get clearance, so they would kind of license IMAX. And then, you know, within 30, 40 miles, there would not be another IMAX theater.
Yeah. It's However, proven a very successful business.
Right. However, what wound up happening with digital is all of these premium large format PLF theaters. And these exhibitors said, wait a second, why are we paying IMAX for digital? We could do that ourselves. You know, we don't have to have IMAX do it anymore. They're not shooting it in IMAX with IMAX
And they're not
film.
Presenting it in IMAX. It's just a big screen. In a lot of IMAX theaters, it's not actual IMAX film. It's just a movie being shown on a big screen.
Right, so AMC has their own branded premium large format. You have Real D, the 3D company, trying to get into the premium large format space. Cinemark here in the United States and elsewhere.
So why would studios, why would the theater owners want to partner with Dolby?
Well, they are a known name, and they are great at marketing, as you can tell from the way they launched Atmos and their immersive sound format, which I think has 700 theaters worldwide right now.
Well, that's nice, but I've never gone to a movie to see it in Atmos. If it's at that theater, that's fine, but I've never said, oh my gosh, I need to see that movie in Atmos.
That's true.
Maybe people are excited in the industry. I don't think it sells a ticket.
Well, they know that Dolby is going to back their products with continued research and development and marketing. But here's the thing. Dolby is also working on kind of a profit-sharing model, the same way IMAX is, which is kind of what turned off many of these large exhibitors to IMAX in the first place.
Right. So why would they make a deal with Dolby?
Well, I think in part the reason they would do this, and here's the rub. This isn't just a big screen. That's not really what they're going after. They're going after Dolby Vision. And what Dolby Vision is HDR, high dynamic range. So again, you might remember a few episodes ago, we talked not about more pixels, 4K, but
better
pixels. Right. So deeper blacks, whiter whites, brighter picture. They're using
Is this technology being used anywhere in the world in theatrical distribution? Can people see it anywhere? Have they done it yet?
They have done it. Ironically, I was reading where they did this. They did it at the Vine Theater in Hollywood. If you knew what the Vine Theater looked like, I mean, this is a pit, this place. I don't know why they chose the Vine Theater. And they also did it at Harmony Gold.
That was just a screening. That was just a showing. That wasn't
Just demonstrations. Because a part of the process here and the part of the reason that they haven't launched this in earnest until now is because they're waiting for laser projection. This laser light source rather than a bulb, lasers, A, they last longer, and B, they cost, well, I guess over time they cost less, and they're much, much brighter.
And so studios, they have a new proprietary way of showing a movie.
Well, that's the question. Is it proprietary or do you really just need, well, Dolby Vision is proprietary.
Yeah.
But the question is, well, couldn't you get high dynamic range without Dolby Vision? Why do you need Dolby Vision? Couldn't you just do HDR in some other format?
But Dolby's offering to pay for the equipment, and theaters just bought all their digital equipment. They're not in the mood to buy a new one, so Dolby says, we'll pay it for you. Just let us take a cut of the profits.
That's right. Now, Dolby has to do a couple things. They have to go out and find movie theater owners who are willing to partner with them and install this new format. They also have to go to studios and actually get the studios on board with actually creating a new master or a new version just for Dolby Vision. And by the way, a lot of this stuff isn't shot in HDR.
Film doesn't need to be, right?
Well, it doesn't need to be. If it's film, it's already HDR. That's already, you know, high dynamic range.
But not being shot in film.
If it's shot in digital, well, you really have to shoot in HDR. It's a very specific, and a lot of cinematographers want to shoot in HDR.
Emmanuel, you mean they're not? What are they shooting in now in digital?
They're using an Arri Alexa, or they're using one of the Sony cameras.
Is it a proprietary camera or a lot of different cameras capable of shooting in HDR?
I think they're slowly coming to market. There's like one or two right now.
So they've got a proprietary way of showing a movie that their trademarked way. Most films aren't shot in HDR yet. Most films certainly aren't shot on celluloid anymore, so they need to get the directors to want to make the movies in HDR, then the studios to release a new master, and then they get the theaters to let them take a cut of their profits in exchange for creating a branded space called Dolby Cinema All so that theatergoers can pay more money.
Yes, because it will cost more money.
Of course it will. Yes. Why else would they do it?
Because you got to pay Dolby.
Because tickets are so cheap already, there's a lot of room to spend more money on tickets to get a better quality experience.
But really, what we're talking about is you can already see theater owners and the exhibition community saying, what can we offer our patrons that they cannot get at home? Now,
yes, but they do that by always charging more. Instead of saying, what can we offer our patrons to make them happy with a lot of money they're already spending and maybe increase their going because, all right, I'm paying $10 a ticket. Maybe I'll be willing to see two movies a month rather than, you know, two movies a year if you make it a much more exciting value for me. No, they just say, well, how can we jack up ticket prices? What a better way to depress movie going? Because then you feel like, unless I see it in that Dolby theater, I'm being screwed. I'm not seeing the actual movie. Unless I see Interstellar in IMAX 70 milliliter, I feel like I'm getting screwed. And why go see it in 2D? I'm seeing a lesser product. Suddenly now, unless you get to one of those special theaters, you feel gypped and it's really expensive. And so you don't go to the movies as much.
Well, I think the irony in this may be that exhibitors are actually partnering with what could be their undoing, but the person that will undo them. Because the reason Dolby wants to get into this business in part is not necessarily for the theatrical experience, but because they can then license it to television manufacturers and bring it into the home. This Dolby Vision, this HDR is in large part a play for...
Well, that's what Dolby always is. That's where they make their money.
That's right. And so here you're going to basically start with theatrical, both for Atmos and Dolby Vision, because then the studios are mastering in HDR or in Atmos, and they're producing content in those formats. But then it's available for the home.
So they're going to be doing laser projections in the home?
Not in the home, but on televisions. Not laser projection in that case, because you don't need to light up a 30-foot screen. But then you have...
So what will the difference be from watching another movie?
It's very clear. When you're watching HDR, the picture is much, much better. I mean, it's kind
4K,
of...
4K, 8K?
It's not... Well, I've only seen it in 4K, 4K HDR. That said, actually, no, maybe I have seen it in 2K. Whatever images I was looking at, it was crisper, brighter... It really was much, much better and noticeably different, unlike 4K, where you don't notice the difference most of the time at all.
But 8K, you probably notice it with that.
Oh, well, 8K, it's almost surreal. It's like you're...
Right, but isn't that what... Aren't we all skipping over 4K? I mean...
Well, no, right? 4K monitors right now are on the market.
But nobody's buying them. 3D TVs are there, but nobody's watching television in 3D, right? 4K has not proven a driver of sales. It may be available, and people may buy it just because it's the only product available, so it has it.
And that's the rub right there. You just hit the nail on the head.
Basically, we're leapfrogging over 4K to maybe 8K, right?
Possibly, but 8K is still many years off.
I'm not buying a 4K TV. I bought a TV a few years ago. It's great. And in 10 years, 8 years, 12 years, when I'm ready to buy another one, it will be an 8K TV, right?
I don't think... Right now, they can't even make 4K work. So until they can make 4K work...
What do you mean it doesn't work?
Well, to get the 4K content from the set-top box to the television. So I don't think we're skipping over 4K. I think you're still going to see 4K probably for about 10 years.
Yeah, but nobody's going to care about it. You can see DivX available for 5-10 years, but nobody bought it. Anyway, it's stupid. It's just another way to jack up prices. Why do theatergoers care? Great. There's only one, my 20-screen multiplex, and only one of those screens is good. That's the message they're sending out. Instead of saying all our screens have great picture and sound, they say, well, if you really want to see the movie, you're going to have to pay $20 for your ticket and go to that special screen. And guess what? It's sold out. So take your pick. You want the inferior product or do you want to go home? That's the message they're telling people.
Well, what do you think of the Grammy nominations, which came out last week? You know, I forgot to mention that in our intro.
Well, you know, tell me about how they came out. That's probably the most interesting thing.
I have no idea. I woke up and there they were. They were just sitting right...
No, they weren't.
Really? No.
They did a whole day thing. They started in the morning on morning television, releasing some nominations, including some big categories like Song and Record of the Year. And then throughout the day, they announced more stuff via TV or streaming video or Twitter. And then they climaxed in the evening with the announcement of Album of the Year. So they sort of turned what is often a one-time event into a day-long extravaganza. I thought it was sort of an interesting way to try and step out from the crowd and build excitement to the Album of the Year nomination.
That said, in this day of receiving tweets on your phone and little notifications on your phone from the LA Times, New York Times, CNN... You know, all day I was getting this, Grammys this or Grammys that. And I kept saying, yeah, I already read about the Grammys. Stop telling me about the Grammy. I thought it was the same one.
Because you haven't.
Yes, I hadn't heard about that particular category.
Well, there you go. If you're a country music fan, you want to know what's up for Country Album of the Year. So the Album of the Year nominations are out. They are Beck for Morning Phase, Beyonce for her surprise album that dropped very immediately and stunned the world. The whole album plus 12 videos for every song is very exciting. Ed Sheeran for Multiply. Sam Smith for his album In the Lonely Hour. He's probably the it boy at the Grammys. And Pharrell Williams for Girl. Those are the albums of the year. What do you think, Sperling?
I would agree with you. Sam Smith is probably the front runner. I'm surprised Ed Sheeran...
I didn't say he was the front runner. I just said he was the it boy.
Okay, true. Ed Sheeran, I'm surprised the name of the album is X. And I mean, Multiply.
It's Multiply, yeah.
Instead of X. Pharrell Williams, the guy is pretty much everywhere.
Right. I feel like his moment passed already. I'm surprised it's a little bit there, but that's okay. Sam Smith is openly gay and has been from the start of his success. That sort of makes his, you know, crowning achievement here at the Grammys kind of fascinating that people just don't even talk about it particularly. It's just, oh, yeah, of course. You know.
We call that a good thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's no country album in the mix for album of the year. In recent years, there's almost always been a country album. So that's a little notable. I think if there was somebody who was going to be there, it would have been Eric Church for his album The Outsiders, which is nominated for Best Country Album. It could have been Miranda Lambert for her new album Platinum. You know, so there were a couple really strong nomination possibilities, but they didn't get into the final album of the year category.
Now, I'm a little surprised at Song of the Year, Taylor Swift for Shake It Off. I know it's catchy, but I don't think it's that great of a song. Do you?
As we've said before, there's a difference between Song of the Year and Record of the Year. Record of the Year, Shake It Off. Hey, it's a catchy song. People, I don't like it, but whatever. If you like it, it's a catchy record. Do you want to hear covers of Shake It Off? Absolutely not. Do you want to hear other artists and other genres cover that song? No. A Song of the Year is supposed to be for the songwriting, and it's supposed to mean this song is a standard, and people are going to sing and record and perform this song for years to come. You can have the greatest song in the world, like Hey Ya by Outkast. Great song. That is not a standard. That is not a Song of the Year. It's a great record. That particular version of that particular song is terrific, you may think, but it's not a Song of the Year. It's not a song that others are going to record. And Shake It Off is a classic example of lazy voting, where they just say, oh yeah, Song of the Year, Record of the Year. But what's fascinating is what's not on these lists of Song and Record of the Year. No Let It Go from Frozen.
That did surprise me.
That is, you know, every 8-year-old girl in the country must have been furious when they heard that news. What? No song from One Direction, who's one of the biggest bands in the world right now and has had a number of really good singles. Again, 8-year-old girls are furious. And then their mothers are angry because John Legend did not get nominated for All of Me for Song or Record of the Year. Terrific ballad, huge hit, big, big smash all over the world. He is nominated in some categories, but that is a song that feels like a song that will be recovered and recorded and sung by others for many years to come, certainly in lounge acts all over the world.
What about All About That Bass? Because I don't know if that's going to be recorded years from now.
Well, another example of lazy voting on their part. That was up for Song of the Year and Record of the Year. So the only song that's on the list for record of Song of the Year that did not get into Record of the Year is Hozier's Take Me to Church. So that's a song that they say, hey, this is a great standard, but it didn't quite make it under Record of the Year. The song that took its place is Fancy by Iggy Azalea featuring Charlie XCX. I don't know how to say that.
I don't know.
XS, either. Probably. Charlie XS. I'm obviously not down to my rap people appearing in. So, Iggy Azalea is certainly one of the big names for this list. She's on the best rap album of the year, along with Eminem and some others. You know, they used to look cool just for having a rap album collection, and they would just have the right names because they were so unaware of rap music, and they would be hip just because they were including the category. They couldn't help but be hip. But this year, best rap album with Common and Iggy Azalea and Wiz Khalifa and Schoolboy Q, I think they almost seem a little out of touch, just like they often do with metal and some other categories.
Well, best new artist is a category that has always been kind of, well, some say it's the kiss of death and something of a joke. Others, you know, they don't.
Well, that was long ago. I think it's been pretty a pretty good category in the last decade or so. You know, they really have picked some of the top names in the business. They've all been nominated or won best new artist. And so this year's list is pretty good. Iggy Azalea, Bastille, Brandi Clark, Haim, or Sam Smith. Could be any one of them. I assume Sam Smith, but it could be Iggy Azalea for sure. Those two must be the front runners.
Yes, I would agree. I think it's going to be Sam Smith.
Yeah, he's going to have a great night. That will probably get Song or Record of the Year. We'll have to see. But there's one category I'm really rooting for, and it's Best R&B Album. The nominees are Islander by Bernhoft, Aloe Black with Lift Your Spirit, Toni Braxton and Babyface for their album Love, Marriage, and Divorce. That was quick. Robert Glasper Experiment for Black Radio 2. And Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings for Give the People What They Want. Please, God, let Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings win Best R&B Album. Great album, great artist.
Plus, she just went through a whole cancer treatment.
Oh, right, exactly. She's got a great story, but it's a terrific album. Put all the drama aside. Maybe she has that hook to gain attention. But out of those five albums, it's absolutely the best album. It should have been up for Album of the Year.
So it's kind of a big deal then.
I see what you're doing.
Yes. And anybody that listens to this show on a regular basis probably also sees or hears what I'm doing right now. I'm moving us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, you can say that Sony was a little kind of nervous about this first story over the weekend, over the Thanksgiving break, because James Bond will return. It's been the coda to many a Bond film over the years, the promise of more Bond to come. So it's always been a big deal for fans to hear what the title of the next film will be, who the new Bond girl is. Is that actually sexist? Can I say Bond girl? Or should I say Bond woman? I don't know. Well, you know, so on. But the series has hit new heights of popularity with Daniel Craig. And remember how angry fans were about that casting announcement? So now the news of the Bond, of I guess it's Bond 24 this time, is getting an actual title now. They had to hold a press conference, live streaming from Pinewood Studios and instant tweets. The name? Spectre, spelled the English way, I might add. The additional cast? Christoph Waltz, Lea Seydoux, and Monica Bellucci, among others. Monica Bellucci is now the oldest Bond girl on record at the age of 50, and I'm sure she hates the fact that I'm pointing that out. Most importantly of all,
I'm not, because she looks great.
She looks great, yeah. They waited for director Sam Mendes and took their time with the script. Why mess with a winning formula? Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. It's a very good thing that they waited for Sam Mendes. It's just a smart move to make. Don't rush out the next movie. Wait to have the right people in place with the right script. They've taken their time. It's called Spectre. In the old days, all the Bond films had names pulled from the novels. Then they were pulled from details or characters of the novels because they ran out of books. So now they've finally gone to the one I thought it would have been ages ago. Spectre, the evil organization that Bond is always facing off against. My friend Joe has been saying they should call a Bond film Spectre for years. And the neat thing about Spectre is they're apolitical. They just want power and money. So they aren't aligned with any group. So it's not like a Cold War thing or a us versus China thing. It always feels fresh because Spectre is always there ready to make money.
Get used to it. Bloggers, or in this case, video bloggers, a.k.a. vloggers, they are the real deal. The right personality can become a huge celebrity. Just look at Zoe Sugg. This UK 24-year-old became a YouTube star by gabbing away about her life with a sunny disposition, loads of makeup tips, and positivity that makes her seem like the 21st century Doris Day. No drinking or drugging for this woman. Nicknamed Zoella, she's won big awards, with One Direction, by the way, handing her a trophy at one event.
And, OMG!
Yes, indeed. And now she's even launched her first book, Girl Online, a young adult novel about a girl who does video blogs about her life, just like Zoella. It sold 78,000 copies in the UK, making it the highest-selling debut novel in UK history.
In its opening week.
Mind you, Zoella didn't actually write the whole thing. And this is a quote.
What?
To be factually accurate, you would need to say Zoe Sugg did not write the book Girl Online on her own. Penguin told.
To be factually accurate.
Yes.
Okay. She didn't write it all on her own.
Yeah. By the way, when talking to a newspaper, they tend to like to be factually accurate. FYI.
Well, it depends.
Yes. Good point. And that's what Penguin told the Sunday Times. She worked with a ghostwriter, but insists the characters and story are hers. And Zoella's fans denounce anyone who points this out as haters. Well, you know, Michael, haters are just going to hate. You just have to shake it off.
Oh, God. So I didn't recognize it because I haven't heard that song enough, by the way.
Well, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Not that her book sold so many copies, not that it's ghostwritten, but video YouTube stars are the real thing. They get a big audience. They can platform out to other areas. They can make money just being on YouTube. you know, this is not going away. This is a permanent part of the future. It's kind of like, not to downplay them, but like the minor leagues, you know, you prove yourself there, then you jump to TV, you jump to movies, you jump to books, you jump to whatever, to music. You know, that's, it worked for Justin Bieber. It's working for Zoella. It's going to work for a lot of other people down the road. You gain a lot of followers on YouTube. You're creating content every week. You're a proven commodity and you deserve to be worked into something else like a movie or a TV show. It just makes sense.
I'm sorry, Michael. I wasn't paying attention. I was writing down ideas for my new YouTube show.
Why are we on YouTube? Because we've looked in the mirror.
Yeah, we have a voice for radio and, you know, other parts as well. that may have been taken the wrong way.
It didn't sound right at all.
Yes.
By the way, breaking news, the Scottsboro Boys, one of my favorite musicals of recent years, did win the award for best musical from the Evening Standard. So I'm very excited for that show. If you're in London, check it out. It's a great musical.
Another story from the UK and about books, no less.
Crikey. Oh, wait, that's Australia.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Blimey.
Wrong continent. A judge has ruled a ban on sending books to prisoners in England and Wales is unlawful and has been ended. He pointed out, quite obviously, that books are not just a privilege, but might well be essential to the rehabilitation of criminals, and banning them served no useful purpose whatsoever. The prison secretary, Chris Grayling, insisted there was never a quote-unquote ban. Hey, prisoners had access to a library, and they could buy books from the prison bookstore with the earnings that they, you know, made as a worker. Well, but since those earnings might amount to less than £3 a week, and the number of books one might get from the library is strictly limited, that seemed less than forthright. So did the argument that books sent in from family and friends might be a way to smuggle drugs and other illegal substances. That's totally not true. Everybody knows books shipped in from relatives, that's where you hollow them out, you put a nail file in. Everybody knows that. The ban became a cause célèbre among authors like poet Carol Ann Duffy and fantasy writer Philip Pullman, and they cheered on the decision. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for the prisoners, but I'd love to think of them as rebelling by saying, I want the new Paul Theroux. I want the new, you know, like they're banging on their cages, demanding the latest Philip Roth novel. It's just a surreal idea. But, you know, if they can now, you know, show the finger to the man by reading a book, well, it's better than what else they might be doing in prison.
Oh, I know what they're doing. I saw a TV show about this once. There was like a guy with a tattoo on his back and on his front. And then he like escaped from prison.
Yeah.
Now, how do you top the highest grossing music tour, rock tour in history? Well, actually, you don't really try. If you recall, U2's 360 degree tour, wasn't it the 360 tour? It was delayed at one point by a back injury suffered by the hapless man known as Bono. He's also U2's lead singer. Thanks to a stage setting in the round, it allowed many stadiums to increase ticket sales by like 25% because there were no block seats. They ended up grossing $736 million and selling 7.2 million tickets, more than any other tour in history. So for the Innocence and Experience Tour, this is U2's new tour, the band is starting off slow. First, of course, they delayed the beginning till May because Bono got into a bike accident that led to multiple surgeries. This guy just can't stand up straight, can he?
No.
Thankfully, he's expected to make a full recovery, and for those tired of massive stadium shows, U2 will start with a relatively intimate indoor venues. The first jaunt includes 19 cities and two or three shows at some venues. They could have done many more if they wanted to at each venue. While the tour is on, a follow-up album, companion to the Songs of Innocence, will be released, presumably by more conventional means than the previous one, which was forced into iTunes users' hands.
No, don't give me your brand new album for free. Damn you, U2!
Rolling Stone, by the way, just named the album the number one album of the year. I should probably listen to it then. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's definitely a big whoop.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a big whoop, because I tried to buy tickets to their shows in LA, and I went on to Ticketmaster, and they said, you know, how many seats would you like? Where would you like to sit? And then all of a sudden, there was a little pop-up on their website that said, hey, a lot of people are buying tickets right now. You're now in line. 15-minute wait. It all happened in the blink of an eye.
Tickets are on sale. I'm sorry, they're sold out.
Yes, pretty much. I literally watched it happen online. Normally, you have to actually go and stand in line for that to happen.
Well, you can't do that anymore.
But by the way, these tickets are like $315 in LA. Yeah.
It was the top price?
That's probably a price. I mean,
yeah, I'm sure there's even more premium, but they were, most seats were at maxing out at $350.
When I finally got through, I was sitting in the nosebleeds for $312. I said, hey, you know what? No. Actually.
Oh, you could have still bought a ticket?
Yeah, way up in the nosebleeds.
15 minutes after it went on sale? I'm surprised.
Yeah, so was I, actually. But then when I saw the price, I went, yeah, maybe that's why.
Wow, $350 for the nosebleeds? That's too bad. I mean, I thought it was nice that they were going to do some smaller venues, because I just am tired of stadium tours. I'm not going again. Unless I'm way down front. And in that case, someone's giving me the ticket. I'm not going. I don't want to sit back 50 yards on the side and watch other people watch a show. So the idea of seeing you two in like Madison Square Garden again, that would be exciting. They're a great band. They'd be fun even if you are in the nosebleed section, but $300 for that price is just not good.
Sometimes covering entertainment feels more like covering the legal beat. We need a court reporter. That's what we really need. So Creedence Clearwater Revival was one of the all-time greats, a band that turned out a string of classic albums in a very short period of time before imploding amidst bad feelings all around. The band members hated each other. Hated their manager, hated what happened to their albums on Fantasy, and on and on and on. But you know, haters are going to hate, Michael.
Until?
Yeah. In the 1990s, the band members, who weren't John Fogerty, toured under the moniker Creedence Clearwater Revisited. Get it? John Fogerty sued. The court rulings went in favor of one side and then another until they finally settled, with the band paying money for the rights to use that specific name. But Fogerty continued to badmouth them. So now they're suing him, claiming he broke the agreement and did the same thing himself by advertising shows where he performs the albums of Creedence Clearwater Revival. I guess a reunion is probably out of the question. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. They're just all suing each other. It's too bad. I mean, was he their manager or was he just the record label owner who signed them? Saul Zance, who Tom Fogerty even wrote John Fogerty even wrote a nasty song about, called Zance Can't Dance, or he had to change it actually to Vance, I think, because he was being sued by him. So that was their record label owner, Saul Zance. It was ugly, ugly stuff. It's such a shame. The band was together for like 5 years. They produced so many great albums. Tom Fogerty died of AIDS complications back in 1990, so they can never all get back together. But you know, it's a shame that, it's a shame that there's such a sad legacy for such a great band.
Well, you know what I always say?
What?
Put me in, coach. I'm ready to play.
Solo song.
I know. I was hoping you wouldn't recognize that.
Well, I just wanted to make sure they knew we knew.
Okay. Well, CBS and Dish have come to a multi-year agreement, but it came at a price for the satellite service. Dish is a big satellite cable provider here in the United States, and I believe North America. I don't know if they venture on up to Canada. Dish will carry CBS cable channels and the network around the country. The lawsuits between them have all been dismissed. Now, you might remember these lawsuits are for the Hopper. But in return...
Just between CBS and them.
Yes.
So they were suing each other involving the Hopper and other things. Yeah.
Right. Dish agreed to disable one of its key functions surrounding the recording ability of the Hopper. Dish agreed to disable the ad skipping function for CBS called AutoHop. Quote unquote, only affects CBS shows for 1 week after they've aired. But of course, that's exactly when most TV shows are watched. Dish struck a similar deal, disabling AutoHop with Disney ABC. That deal covered shows for 3 days after they aired. Presumably, you can still fast forward through ads as on any DVR. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for Dish customers. I think they're really, you know, hurting themselves. I mean, I would have a caveat in there that, hey, let's keep suing and find out what the courts say. And if they say it's legal, then it stays. Or some, I mean, I don't know. It's just, you're offering up something that differentiates you from everybody else and giving it up in dealings with CBS and Disney. And guess what? Everybody else is going to demand the same thing. And how can you deny them? So I don't know. To me, it just seems like a bad idea. I mean, if I love Dish, I love it for the reason I can get stuff there I can't get anywhere else. And that includes AutoHop.
Yeah, well, I think the lawyers probably said, look, you know, you're basically...
I don't think their lawyers said it was illegal. They wouldn't have gone to court if their lawyers told them in advance, this is bullshit. I think the problem is that they just don't want to have, not have CBS on their offerings. You know, their customers get very angry and they all yell at Dish. They're not going to yell at CBS. You know, they say, hey, I'm paying you money. Where's my CBS?
I would have no problem with these retransmission disputes with broadcast networks if they didn't. I mean, they're pulling their signal from Dish, and they did that for 12 hours before Dish and CBS settled. And if you're a broadcast network, you actually have to perform a public service. You're given airwaves, you're given spectrum. You shouldn't be allowed to pull your service from...
Well, you got to go cable only if you want to pull that nonsense. You can pull your cable channels, but you shouldn't be able to pull your... But they would say, well, we only are forced to provide it over the air to antennas, not to people who are buying it via Dish.
Yes, true. But at the same time, if there was a huge catastrophe, let's say, you know, something, heaven forbid, like 9/11...
Well, we'd all turn to CNN.
That's right. We probably wouldn't be watching CBS. Serves you right. George Lucas really has nothing to do with the new Star Wars movie being made by J.J. Abrams. Really. Orson Welles once called getting to direct a movie akin to a boy being given a toy train set. Well, the Star Wars universe may be one of the greatest franchises anyone ever got to play with, but Lucas is taking no pleasure in it. When asked by Page Six of the New York Post what he thought of the new trailer, Lucas said he hadn't seen it. He'll wait till the movie comes out. Is he excited to see what Abrams is doing with it? Not really, says Lucas. Well, alrighty then. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal.
What?
Because he really is not involved. It may actually be a good movie. The guy clearly has no investment in it. He's already girding his loins to have everybody say, it's the best Star Wars movie since Empire Strikes Back. So I think he's mentally locking himself down. I don't care what they do with it. I'm not interested. Nothing to do with me. And frankly, if he's not involved, there's a better chance it'll actually be good.
That's
Hence,
true.
It's actually. A big deal. Thank you, Mr. Lucas. Now stay away from the Blu-rays so they can put out the original versions. But anyway.
Well, they can put out the original versions. And here's why.
Oh, God. They can put the money in and make it happen.
Okay, yes. Okay, so you know why they can't. They basically have no negative. So
it's work. It needs to be restored. I think Star Wars is worth restoring.
I would agree with you. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And oh my goodness, are they buzzing about this story.
I think this is why Citizen 4 is going to win Best Documentary Film and may even get nominated for Best Picture, because Hollywood is going to be so empathizing with the sense of other people spying on you and looking at you and watching your every movement that they're going to be like, yeah, that's terrible. they're going to help push Citizen 4 over the top, because this is a big, big story. Sony was hacked. We don't know by whom, but they've released about 40 gigabytes of information, something like that. And they've stolen, they say, about 100 terabytes of information.
Now, 100 terabytes is a lot of data. That's all their data.
But of course, it includes emails from me to you at Sony saying, hey, let's go out to lunch.
Correct.
Yeah. So it's everything.
But I actually hacked in and deleted all those.
good idea. Even the Sony gym had to be shut down. I'm not quite sure why.
Actually, I know a couple of people who the week this happened went over to Sony and they were given passes that were handwritten. They were, you know, John Doe here to see James Smith.
Oh,
you know,
interesting.
They just, you know, put this in your car. I'm like, great. You have no record that I actually am walking onto the lot. Don't worry. I'm not going to hack you. I'm just going to steal everything.
Now, federal officials are investigating, but it's the FBI. And I'm wondering why it isn't the CIA. Because it's international in scope, we believe it. We know
it falls,
that some of the
for right now, it falls under the FBI. If it becomes international in scope and it becomes an international intelligence issue, then yes, the CIA will be involved.
The first question is, who did it? Sperling?
I did. I mean, yeah.
That's not true. Because something happened at a local level that they thought, is it an inside job? Is it North Korea? Because, of course, Sony has a movie coming out called...
The Interview, and it stars Seth Rogen and James Franco. In fact, Seth Rogen made $8.4 million, and James Franco made $6.5 million, according to the documents I read.
Seth Rogen got paid more than the handsome and beautiful James Franco. Good God! Well, and Kevin Federline, the ex of Britney Spears, got $5,000 for a cameo. $5,000. Why would you even just give it to charity? I mean, $5,000. But anyway, I'm sure it was like an hour.
Giving it to Kevin Federline is giving it to charity.
Oh, poor guy. No, that's just, you know, sometimes people are doing it just to do it. You know, he wasn't doing it for the money, obviously. They have to pay you something. It's a nominal little amount. Just, you know, it's fun. He wants to be in it. They want him to be in it. And everybody's happy. So that's the point of that. It's not actually an embarrassing fact for Kevin Federline. Nor is it embarrassing that James Franco got less. Maybe Seth Rogen was the first one to make it happen. I don't know.
Or he was producing or wrote part of the script or whatever.
That's right. But information is pouring out. This movie is got, it involves assassination attempt on the head of North Korea, the brutal dictator of that country. And that's why people thought, gee, maybe this is North Korea. Certainly the text that we've seen from the hackers is in poor English, which could be a feint, a way to trick you, but it seems like it was written by somebody whose English is a second language for them. It's not very good English. It's not very grammatical. The group is called the Guardians of Peace, or GOP, which also is a little silly because GOP refers to the Republican Party to most Americans. Another thing that makes you think this is from overseas. North Korea was coy. Then they said, no, absolutely not. But we think actually maybe they are.
Well, but here's the thing. Many security experts, cybersecurity experts, are saying, you know, for this much data, 100 terabytes of data to flow out
doesn't
of
doesn't mean they didn't have an insider.
Right.
It doesn't mean they didn't pay off somebody tons of money or whatever. It just means that, you know. Oh, Seth Rogen co-directed it, by the way. And he worked on the story. So that's why he got more money.
Okay. Well, as you say, Michael, now signs are pointing to an insider because they just knew too much.
Well, no, but it's not pointing to an insider. They tracked some of the hacking to a Thai hotel to the release of information. They also tracked info that some of the info was released over an open university system, which is something that hackers often do. They go to college campuses or other places with open networks and release info there so it can't be traced back to them.
They hack into those systems and then place the information there so it can't be traced.
So I don't think it's clear that it's an insider in the sense of a disgruntled employee that has nothing to do with a foreign power. Given how elaborate and successful it is, I think it's more likely that it is, you know, I mean, some people are claiming it's really, really sophisticated. This wasn't like you shoved in a thumb drive and downloaded some documents.
Well, no. However, the knowledge of the network, apparently cybersecurity experts are saying it would have taken months to figure out how to get from server to server. So there's no way. Well, there's few ways that could have been done without inside knowledge. Now, that said, Sony has been laying people off, laying employees off for years now.
Well,
and so there's
any
number of, you know, disgruntled employees.
That's implying that you would have to be really sophisticated. But as we know, even elaborate studio systems probably are not designed for international attacks from outsiders. People just don't think that way. And there could be some simple back door where you went in one way and suddenly found, oh, my God, I've stumbled on the riches, right?
No. Not if they were small. I mean, not most cases, not most corporate.
You don't think France could have hired people to attack Sony and figure out and with their resources do something really big and damaging like this?
Yes, they could have. However, okay, so I'm agreeing with you. Yes, they could do that.
Uh-huh.
However, in doing that, you tend to notice 100 terabytes of data, which takes weeks to move across networks, especially external networks.
They're not on site. I'm sure they have stuff stored in the cloud. They have stuff stored on third-party systems out somewhere else. This is not stuff locked down in a vault at Sony.
These were all in their data centers. So these were all their servers.
They have their own servers and no others else anywhere in the world?
Well, it wasn't just out of Culver City. It was, you know, their servers all over the world. They basically hacked into the network and took everything that was on the network. In fact, what is pointing to North Korea more and more, or...
Wait, you said it was an insider.
With an insider.
Well, that's North Korea. It doesn't matter who they get to turn. That means it's North Korea. It doesn't mean it's a disgruntled insider. Don't make it about them firing employees. It's about a country targeting a big business.
Right.
Which happens every day. Corporate conspiracy and corporate spying is like the number one thing that the U.S. actually works on overseas worldwide. I'm not the number one thing, but it's a big, big priority because that's our economy and that's our big business. And those are the donors and those are the people that want protection. And that's a huge, huge priority for you know, national security.
Yes, it is.
So what is pointing it to North Korea as opposed to some guy with a thumb drive?
Well, and that's not to say there wasn't some guy with a thumb drive who basically just...
A really big thumb drive.
Well, or you know, hand-carrying
10,000 thumb drives.
But there was a zero-day exploit that was launched, which actually destroyed data. And that
I
is...
I don't know what that means.
It's an exploit that launches at a specific period of time and locks people out of systems, and it's hidden until that point.
Right, that's not like all those viruses that you get that they suddenly blow up in your face and they've been on your computer for 6 months, but on like September 5th or June 4th, suddenly they go into effect.
Yeah, normally hackers will break into a network and try and look around and steal whatever they want to steal or do whatever they want to do and then get out before anybody notices. What this particular attack did was they broke in and didn't care whether they were noticed. In fact, they started deleting data, which is something that most hackers don't do because they just want to get the data. Deleting data actually then says, hey, somebody's been here. So they tend not to delete data. However, usually or traditionally, when data gets deleted, it's usually a government agency or a government operation that's doing it.
But they are leaking out documents a la Anonymous bit by bit. I don't mean to equate Anonymous, which is a different political beast, with this attack. So I should just say they're putting out information piece by piece. They're not putting it all out there at once. And they are releasing, it seems like, everything.
First of all, morale at Sony is kind of like at an all-time low.
Now, why? I would think when there's an attack or something like that, people would rally around and be like, screw them. You know, we're going to, you know, if it's about this movie, screw them. We're going to make this the biggest comedy of all time, a cause célèbre. I mean, I just would think sometimes, you know, when danger strikes, that's when people come together. Why is everybody so depressed?
Well, I think that's finally starting to happen. But I think nobody was certain how much data there was. Now they've just kind of resigned themselves to everything we've ever done is going to be known.
Right.
So, and that's part of the issue, because the first thing that was released was all this, you know, 27 gigabytes to 32 gigabytes of data, HR data, human resources data. So all of
the salaries of the top executives.
Yes.
Right. So social security numbers for people. They'll all have to get new social security numbers.
47,000.
Every single person who's ever gotten a check from Sony should get a new social security number. Every single person.
I'm just trying to, in my own mind, go back. I don't think I've ever received a check from Sony.
I don't know. I may have. I'll have to check. Information on their health insurance, termination information, on and on and on. I mean, it's really amazing. And we're just starting, right?
Yes. Well, and what's now being discussed is the kind of collateral damage that this is causing to people's careers, that when they go for another job, everybody will know whether they've been terminated in the past, what their previous salary was.
If they comb through the data.
And they're
all doing it? Is everybody in Hollywood doing it? You downloaded the information.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, it's not a crime, I don't think, is it?
I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, so, I can tell you that I have seen the data, and it is unremarkable. I mean, you're absolutely right. There's security in obscurity, meaning that...
so much info that some of it will get lost.
I mean, it is tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of... I mean... photocopies of receipts, scans of bills, and not just from the United States, but from all over the world. And here's what has Hollywood on edge, is that Sony distributes films for other studios in
Universal
other parts of...
Universal and Buena Vista International.
Yeah, in Latin America, yeah. In Brazil, it's Universal Pictures and Disney. So all of the money coming back, all of that detail is in there. And it's really quite enlightening. I mean, it's...
Well, and boo-hoo, people say, oh, Sony may have trouble doing new deals because people will know what they offered last time to somebody else or how much movie a movie made. But it will also affect other deals from other studios because people can see the inner workings of a studio and pretty much assume that similar stuff is going on at Universal and Disney and Warner Brothers and Paramount and so on.
Exactly. So now if you're an agent, you're going to say, hey, you know what? I'm not going to agree to that term. I don't have to because, you know, the contract for some other client that I don't represent or some other actor or director, they didn't have to agree to that. We're not going to agree to that either.
Is this really going to be a nuclear bomb in the industry? Is it really going to upend like agreements and deals and contracts? Is everybody going to be yelling and screaming at each other for the next year or two?
It's not about yelling and screaming at each other in the moment.
No, when they're making a deal.
Yes, I think, you know, at least for the next year or two, anything that comes out, people will know, and it's really hard. I mean, literally, journalists, as you say, are kind of combing through this. And really, the only... So you have security through obscurity until such point as somebody puts all
Did you read that this morning or something? Security through obscurity?
No, it's a well-known kind of cybersecurity. Like, in other words, you have that kind of security until such time as somebody puts all of the important information together and deletes all the junk and says, look, here are the 20,000 most important documents. Here are the contracts.
And journalists will do that. Somebody could write a book.
That's true. And I would not be shocked if that actually happens. Because some of this data is fascinating. It goes all the way back to, 1999, 1998, 2000. And you can see information for releases in countries that you wouldn't even think of. For instance, virtual print fee agreements, highly confidential.
Highly.
Highly. They're all, the potential is that they're all going to be kind of leaked out and everybody will know what the virtual print fee was for everybody. Technicolor, they may have given preferential pricing to Sony or vice versa, may not have given preferential pricing to Sony, and some other studio might find out and go back to Technicolor or Deluxe or any one of these service providers and say, hey, you know what?
I want that deal.
Right.
Chances are they all probably have a similar deal, though, don't you think?
Well, this most favored nations thing is kind of...
They legally have to, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you, I just added a link because it just occurred to me. I was looking at an archive. There's a museum or a university with a display of Gone with the Wind, and it's at Texas, and it just talks about the production history of that movie, and they have an online version of it, which is really cool, and you go through the production history of buying the rights to the book, and the teletype messages sent back from David O. Selznick and to, casting people or the woman looking at the book rights and stuff like that. They didn't want to communicate by phone. That was not very secure. It was tricky. The letters took too much time. Telegrams were read by others. So they had teletypes set up. So there's this huge documented list of everything going on in this movie. And of course, it's one of the big movies of all time. But so you see like the back and forth text where they tell each other, it's like texting really. He's like, I don't know about this book. She's like, no, my God, it's so good. He's like, well, I don't know if we could get Ronald Coleman. She's like, oh no, And so I've been going through old memos, essentially, date by date, looking at casting of Scarlett, the tours that they did, a map of where they went around. It's fascinating.
It's actually
really cool. And I imagine there's a lot of great stuff to be had from here. But let's keep this in perspective. They've also sent an email from the hackers threatening people's families. It's not just like, business might be difficult. I don't take that seriously, but it's hard not to be creeped out and scared by that, especially if you're a Sony employee.
Well, and much like nobody knows whether that email threatening,
was actually from them or someone else.
Right. And now there's some discussion, and I kind of knew this would come. Maybe those movies that were leaked out, the movies that I guess one current movie and a couple upcoming movies were leaked out.
Maybe that was them too.
Maybe. Well, no, they initially kind of pegged these hackers, the GOP, as the reason for that. But now, of course, all those movies are screeners. Those are being prepared right now. More than, there's a good chance that the two are not related and just
are a lot of other movies available in advance. I would have thought Annie was a little unusual that it was out online before it was in theaters.
It is. But since they're all coming from one studio, it kind of points to a post-production leak.
Ah. Well, what I found really interesting was the fact that it said hackers released some ultimates. That's in quotes. Ultimates.
That's a Frisbee game, and they were playing in the park, I saw.
That's data on whether a film ultimately proved profitable after all the money from theatrical and DVD sales and rentals and TV and other ancillary markets are added up. The Hollywood Reporter calls this, quote, among the most closely guarded secrets in Hollywood, end quote. I've never even heard the term ultimates. And I'm like, if you're suing, if you're Art Buchwald or you're somebody suing a studio claiming that TV show, that movie is profitable, why aren't the ultimates the first thing you demand during discovery?
Well, because they never actually wind up finding them.
Well, obviously they can't do that. That's against the rules.
Well, good luck trying to find it in their...
I mean, if you are actually think you're going to get a cut of the profits, how can you not want to demand the ultimate?
Well, that's really the big thing here is that you're seeing it. People are finding out all the dirty laundry. They're finding out all the real details, not the details.
Oh, that movie actually made a lot of money. Oh, yeah. That movie actually was a bomb, even though we pretended it was good. I do not support the hacking. I feel sorry for Sony as much as one can for a big multinational corporation. I certainly feel sorry for the people who've had their privacy violated. But got to admit, it's out there, and now I want to see the ultimates.
And that's not a movie.
Is that wrong? Is that, I don't know.
Yeah, it does feel kind of...
But I always wanted the Ultimates. It's got nothing to do with them, and I don't encourage anybody to do anything illegal to get it, but by God, I want to see the Ultimates.
They should actually, Sony, I know they'll never do this, but they should say, here you go, here's all the information.
Well, it's hard. They already have, unfortunately.
Yeah, just not knowingly.
This isn't just a little story. And you know, Seth Rogen and James Franco and the people behind the movie, I haven't heard a word from them. They don't.
What are you talking about? Seth Rogen and James Franco were on Saturday Night Live making fun of them of the hack that all their Christmas.
Did they? Yeah, I didn't see a quote from them anywhere. Like, oh, this is a terrible. I feel like they're like, we just wanted to make a comedy. We didn't want an international incident.
What they should really do is I don't know, I haven't seen the movie, but if you really wanted a, you know, publicity stunt, you actually take the movie to Kim Jong-un and show it to him, because I'm sure
how is that gonna happen? What are you talking
I don't know
about?
You call him, he's a big movie fan, apparently. He said he's gonna watch it.
Not with them.
You're not with them.
North Korea, it's a dictatorship.
I'm just saying,
the most brutal countries in the world. It's a nightmare place to live, a literally Orwellian nightmare.
I did like the email from Kevin Mandia. Mandiant is the corporation, so he's the head of Mandiant, the cybersecurity organization that's now handling this for Sony. He says to Michael Linton, the head of Sony Pictures, he says, our team continues to aid Sony Pictures' response to the recent cyber attack against your employees and operations. I wanted to take a moment to provide you with some initial thoughts on the situation. He says, this attack...
Haven't we already covered all this?
Yes, but there's a reason I want to read this. It says, this attack is unprecedented in nature. The malware was undetectable by industry standard antivirus software. Yeah, no duh. That's what a zero-day exploit is. So I don't know, like, where's the news here? Like, why is he... You're paying this guy? Somebody give me a... Get me Michael Linton on the phone. I'm going to become his cybersecurity consultant. Because if all I have to say is stuff like that, then... No wonder they got hacked.
Oh, okay, yeah. He says, the FBI got involved. Thank you very much. We know that.
Yeah, by the way, you know who told Michael Linton that before you? CNN! So, yeah, I mean, I found that the email a little bit like, why is he sending this email out? It's all the stuff they can find out by reading the newspaper.
Yeah, no, it's a little silly. So, and that's maybe more idea of embarrassing things that will come out from the hack itself. Things that make you look stupid, make you look dumb. Give away trade secrets, make you weaker in bargaining positions for years to come. We'll have to see what happens. So that's not the death of Sony, though. They'll come back from this. But it is the death of the father of video games.
Wait, how are those two related?
I don't know, but I just did it.
I don't even know how to respond to that. So I think it's... But you know what? Actually, our listeners...
Oh, are you going to do email now?
Yeah. Yes, I'm going to... Okay. Thank you. Our listeners know how to respond to us was the end of that sentence, and thus listener email. And in fact, actually, listener posts...
Oh, who did it come from?
It came from Ralph Silva via Google...
How did he send it to us?
Google Plus, actually.
Okay, keep continuing.
Okay, yeah, he writes, on the net neutrality issue...
So this Michael, is about net neutrality?
Yes, it's about net neutrality, which we're not going to get into, so don't worry. We're not getting in... Yeah, he says that Michael is dead wrong. Almost all his words on the issue were wrong. Sperling holds the correct position. Jeez, Mike, let the guy finish a sentence!
I don't know what he's talking about.
Actually, you know what? This is from... Now, it was posted only recently, but it was from an episode a few weeks ago where we got very heated and we kind of had a bit of a debate about net neutrality. Now, we're not going to get into that debate again, but if you go back a couple episodes...
I have never stopped you from finishing a sentence, by the way. I don't think that's fair at all.
Okay. You do realize that... Well, never mind.
Let's move on to the next one. Thank you for writing, Ralph, though. I wish you'd explain to us why, but we appreciate you weighing in. Obviously, we know Sperling's right, so that's it.
I wish
more people would write in and say Sperling's right and Michael's wrong.
Well, yeah, and I not only that, but I would love it if people could just write in and say I'm right without actually... I say I'm right all the time without having to back myself up. I like the fact that somebody can say, look, he's right, and just walk away. And by the way, that episode was 257 on net neutrality, if you want to look it up. But now, Michael, I know we have this email from... I feel like David Knight has become our Matt Damon. You know, David Knight, at the end of every episode, we're going to say, and David Knight, we just ran out of time. Sorry, we'll try and invite you back, with your next movie.
But we're trying to give an opportunity for the anonymous person who talked with us the last time or who gave us info to weigh in on this before we go into detail about theater screens versus capacity and all that sort of stuff. So that's why we sort of delayed a week or two. But we'll tackle it next week no matter what. It's an email talking about the issue of movies and running time, whether Interstellar or how much money it could have made, screen capacity, and all that sort of stuff. It's a very numbers-heavy email.
That's true, and David Knight sent it in, and he makes some very good points here, and I promise you, we will read it on the next
response episode. Or no response from our mysterious studio source.
You know, I'm actually going to start going through the email at Sony and see if it came from there. But now, if you want to write to us, of course, you can do so. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to follow us. At Showbiz Sandbox is our Twitter account. Or you can like us on Facebook, where it's facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can find our page. You can also subscribe to our show. And we really urge you to do so in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free is usually where you can find our show. All that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it kind of shifts around a little bit, kind of like, you know, the GOP. Hey, Michael, what's your website this week?
It's iamsony.com.
iamsony.com. Now, we need like 10 more people to say it. Right?
And then we'll get hacked.
That's true. I am not Sony. Michael Sony. Don't hack me.
But whatever pleasure we take from the details and information of doings of the industry, it's a sad thing, and it's really upsetting for people who are actually involved. And, you know, we're sorry that it all happened.
That is true, because, you know, all things being equal,
it's really unpleasant to have your privacy. I've had friends happen. It's really awful.
Well, you know, Michael, if people can't find your writing there, maybe they should head on over to the Huffington Post, where some of your work on the entertainment industry can be found, or michaelgiltz.com, where you compile all your writing.
That's right.
Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.